Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Professor Paul Grout from the Centre for Market and Public Organisation at the University of Bristol. We met in June 2009 when we spoke about his new report called Private Delivery of Public Services. I began by asking Paul to give an overview of the history of the delivery of public services by both the private sector and the public sector, starting from around the 1970s.
Right, well, the 70s is a good point to start, actually, because that probably now, viewing from the early part of the 21st century, was the high point of the delivery of public services by the public sector. Indeed, at that point, there was so much public involvement in the delivery of public services throughout the world, with the exception really of America, the public services and the public sector had almost become intertwined in people's minds. But since then, of course, there's been huge waves of privatization, movement towards public-private partnerships, and now growth in the not-for-profit sector. And so there's been quite a significant movement away from the public delivery. So now one needs to be quite cautious and draw a very clear line between public services and the public sector. Probably the biggest movement has been as a result of privatization. Indeed, at around about 2003, about $3 trillion worth of assets have been privatized into the private sector from the public sector. This amounted to about 18% of the whole global stock market, and outside of the US, it was almost 40% of the world stock market. Now, all of these activities weren't public services, but a large amount was, and that gives some kind of indication. And even PPPs, which are much more what you might think of as the new kid on the block. In Europe alone, there's been 200 billion euros worth of PPPs signed and closed up to about 2007.
So your report describes these sort of basically three different models of private involvement in public services: privatisation, which you mentioned, public-private partnerships, the PPPs, and then these not-for-profit organisations. Can you explain broadly what these three different models are and why you might think about using one rather than the other?
It's probably better to do it the other way around and talk a little bit about generally why you might be interested in having something that isn't public sector at all. There are two big obvious reasons why it's good to have the private sector around. One is that there's something innately different in the private sector. One of the obvious things is the private sector is interested in profits in a way that the public sector isn't, and will be motivated to maximise those profits wherever possible. Given the contracts aren't complete, and therefore you can't just simply get the private sector to replicate what the public sector would do, or vice versa, you'll always have a lot of grey areas. What you will find in the private sector is you would then expect in these grey areas that the private sector will introduce activities and be motivated to do things that maximise profits. Unfortunately, this will even be at the point at which quality may suffer. In the public sector, you have much less incentive to be efficient, or at least good reasons why that often doesn't happen. But of course, at least quality then will be taken into account. So the sector may be quite critical. Where the downside of an activity in terms of quality where you chase costs is very bad, brain surgery being an obvious example, you may want this to remain in the public sector. And so some of the public innate inefficiency is worth bearing for the fact that you don't really want reductions in quality. At the other extreme, things like dustbins, where the world doesn't come to an end if the dustbins don't get emptied for a week, but you may be very concerned about costs, then it may be very useful to have a private sector operator who's chasing the efficiencies, even though the quality may be slightly lower as a result. So at a very simple level, you can view this sort of trade-off between a private sector which has lower costs but unfortunately less interest in quality, against a public sector will be more driven by quality but costs would be rather lower. So that's one of the obvious reasons, that there is literally something different about the sectors. The other big story is that actually it isn't really about the differences in the sectors so much as competition. And the private sector is very good because it enables competition, because you can have lots of private sector producers. So this, in a sense, is the private sector bringing benefits in an indirect way, in that it just enables to have more players. And either of these reasons, as the evidence seems to suggest, are actually quite important. This would tend to suggest that you may then just want private delivery. But actually, that's probably not a good model for lots of services. So the initial wave of privatisation basically did exactly this, just took public services out of the public sector and put them in the private sector. The fact that this isn't appropriate for lots of services is why we now have later interest in partnership models rather than full privatisation models, and even more recently, renewed interest in not-for-profit models.
So let's talk about how these different models of private delivery of public services, what we know about how well they performed. I mean, perhaps we could start off with privatisation, as that was the first big movement, starting, I guess, in the early 1980s in the UK, and then has spread around the world since then. So I guess that particular form has been a great success story. Would that be right?
Yes, I think that you can generally portray it around the world as a great success story. Although I think, to be absolutely honest, it was also driven by political motives as well. It's relatively well documented that where you have more privatisation, this does tend to lead to a tendency for people to be more right-wing in their voting habits. Although that's not absolutely generally true. But so as well as the desire to improve incentives, a lot of privatisation was also going hand in hand with governments that wish to move the economy more towards the right. The general message there, I think, if you take a broad brush, is that, yes, privatisation has led to greater investment, lower prices, improved productivity. This isn't the case everywhere, but generally that's true. There are also two related messages which I think are worthwhile. One is that the benefits are greatest where they've been associated with liberalisation of activity. So it's not actually moving it to the private sector alone that matters. It seems to be that you need to liberalise and free up the market. So reduced regulation, reduced control, and just general liberalisation seems to be important. And that message that it's not just privatisation, that you do get more of an effect if you liberalise the markets, is true both across all the developing countries and has been found throughout the OECD as well.
Now, what about public-private partnerships? This seems to have caused more controversy. There seems to be a lot of debate, certainly in this country, about the pros and cons, and that's still continuing. What's the evidence we have on their performance?
Yes, I mean, that is more complex. Of course, the reason that you're doing it is in itself more complex, and that's worth taking into account. Often you can't just implement the simple full privatisation model. Maybe impractical, if you think of an urban road network, it's very, very hard to charge for that. There may be poverty in a country, in which case the government can't really just step back and push something out into the private sector. For some activities, the only purchasers ever the government, like defence, national defence, things of that sort. In lots of areas, there have been anti-privatisation pressures. So all these things have led governments, partly politically and partly for good economic reasons, to move towards more of a partnership model, which is often easier to sell as well. The partnership process, you could think of it very crudely as two different waves. The first wave was really just an outsourcing wave, where you have a series of contracts between the public sector and the private sector delivery. These models have generally throughout the world been very successful. There's no doubt, if you look at the data, that it has led to cheaper delivery. It appears that the evidence suggests that a lot of this is purely as a result of the competition, rather than the fact that it is the private sector that's doing it. In lots of instances, for instance, where there's contracting competitions, the public sector delivery mechanism may themselves be allowed to compete in the auction as one of the possible suppliers. And the evidence has shown that where the public sector wins the auction, they themselves are vastly an improvement on the old public sector delivery mechanism. So you don't have to have the private sector doing this to get most of the benefits. There is some evidence that it still matters if a private sector player wins, but the competition seems to be the big driver. So the outsourcing part is relatively straightforward. There's not even a lot of evidence that quality has been reduced as well. Much more complex are the more modern partnership models. Well, I call them modern. They've been around for a long while, but there's been a big new wave of what we think of as PFI type partnership models. The structure of these models is typically the private sector invests a large amount of money up front. They sign a very long contract with the public sector, 25 years, even 40 years is quite common. The private sector owns the asset, which may be a road or a hospital building, and the public sector buys the service year on year from the private sector. Now, these models, there's a good economic argument for them, in the sense that one of the worries of the old public sector delivery model is the private sector would buy, say, a road, the private sector would build it, and then just basically walk away and build another road for someone somewhere else. If anything went wrong 10 years down the line, and this would be true for a hospital building or something, then you have a very complex legal battle if you want to prove that it was actually the private sector builder that was at fault. So the attraction of buying the service, that is, you only pay while the product, the road or the building is delivering a service, means that as soon as problems arise, the private sector loses money. So therefore, they have a much stronger incentive to build a good asset that will last for a long time, and of course have an incentive to get it built quickly so that the money starts flowing quickly. So that's, this sort of model is a slightly different model. It's been very, very popular. You can see politically why it's hugely popular, because the government don't have to find the money for the road straight away, and they don't have to find the money. They pay over 25 years, over 40 years, so you can get your infrastructure improved very rapidly without having to do a lot of government expenditure, although, of course, the commitment for the government is still the same. Now, growth in this area has really been in the kind of 90s. That was the huge growth area, and is still going on now. So when you're talking 25 and 40-year contracts, we haven't really got to see these all the way through. What evidence there is does suggest that things do get delivered much more quickly, which is good. There's not really enough evidence to know yet whether the quality is a lot better. We'll have a much clearer view of that, say, in about 10 years' time. But the simple idea of things get delivered on time seems to be very strong. They aren't any cheaper. That seems to be the case. In fact, on the contract, they look a lot more expensive than public sector delivery, but the history of public sector delivery has always been one of cost overruns. And indeed, if you look, there's been a big study done in the European Union of PFI partnership roads relative to old public sector roads, and the extra cost at the signing of the contract of the PFI roads has turned out to be almost exactly the same as what the cost overrun was on the public sector. So although the PFI look a lot more expensive, when you take the cost runs, overruns into account, they roughly cancel out. So those bits of the story are looking quite promising. There's been some pretty horrendous stories of PFI contracts and PPPs that haven't gone well, but there's plenty of horrendous stories in the public sector as well, so you can't read much into those. It's worth mentioning two other points that are quite interesting here. One is renegotiation. Globally, renegotiation of these 25 or 40-year contracts is a huge problem. In a big World Bank study, they found that 3/4 of all water concessions were renegotiated within a few years, and half the road concessions. So what these 25-year contracts mean has to be dealt with very carefully, and it matters a lot what quality of the legal system is. And it's quite clear if you look where the money's been spent over the last 15 or 20 years. Countries that are do quite well on corruption indices get a lot more of this money than countries that do very badly. And the other issue is there's been a big problem about procurement, which of course may also relate to the renegotiation. Procurement in the old public sector model was one of the less exciting jobs in the public sector. You procured the hospital, somebody came along and built it, but it was the people who ran it, people who controlled it. These were the people who had the power, and this would be the same in road networks and things of that sort. Of course, now in these new models, that power, the control of the organisation, is going over to the private sector. So within the public sector, the procurement job, getting this job done properly and cheaply, is actually now really important. In fact, if you're signing a 25-year contract with a single supplier, then in a sense that single supplier is in a monopoly position for the next 25 years. So the contract up front and the competition needs to pull out any profitability that will happen to that, and that is quite important. So there's been a bit of a mismatch around the world between the people historically who are in these procurement positions and suddenly the scale of the job that they are being requested to do. And this is, again, globally is a problem. And there's been a problem in the sort of advanced European economies as well as elsewhere. So there's a little bit of uncertainty about how this model will play out. And politically, it's not hugely popular with the unions. So globally, the word partnership was jumped on to some extent because it wasn't privatisation, which was a bit unpopular. But now the same thing's happening to the partnership, which leads us, of course, to not-for-profit, which is the next place to go.
I was going to say, what about this model? This is a model with which I think most people are a bit less familiar, but I mean, it's talked about a lot in the UK these days particularly, maybe elsewhere too.
Well, globally, it's becoming important. And one does wonder the extent to which this is being, the movement is, if profit incentives are bad and unpopular electorally, then not-for-profit must be good. Of course, then you're just replacing one set of incentives with another set of incentives. But you're quite right, there's definitely a move in the UK, there's a move elsewhere in Europe and globally. The delivery of lots of projects around the world have historically been done by not-for-profit organisations, NGOs, but this is actually definitely a growth area. The evidence is really mixed. There is plenty of evidence to show that not-for-profit organisations are more efficient in some areas, but then there's plenty of other examples. So there's no clear message at all comes through that literature. I should say, however, of course, quite a bit of this literature is in the medical markets in the US, which may be a little bit specialised and may not therefore transfer to NGOs in Europe or NGOs in Africa or something of that sort. But there's no clear message come through. There are certain clear things. There's definitely a clear message that if you look at what we refer to as pro-social behaviour, the willingness of employees and people in the organisation to go the extra mile beyond what's required in any contract, beyond what's required for their personal career concern. There's undoubted evidence that this is much stronger and much higher in not-for-profit than for-profit organisations. However, I suppose the critical question is that because non-profit organisations just attract these kind of people? Or is it that as they leave a for-profit to a not-for-profit organisation, people actually do more of giving of the extra mile? That is, they do more of pro-social behaviour. The evidence on this, what we have, is it's not hugely strong at the moment, but unfortunately what it does suggest is that people don't seem to change their behaviour. So what we seem to have out there is a group of people who engage in pro-social behaviour, who are caring, who are always willing to go the extra mile. And although these are attracted to the not-for-profit deliverers, this doesn't actually make them do more of it. So in some sense, it's more of a transfer of this rather than that the not-for-profit actually means that we deliver more pro-social motivation in society. So there's a lot of uncertainty as to whether the real drive for this is much more of a political drive than a sort of underlying economics show that it's obviously the way to go forward. So there does appear to be a little bit of a history here that politicians keep moving towards something that looks like it will be more saleable to the electorate.
We're nearly 2 years into our global financial crisis and at least a year into a global economic downturn that's worse than anything that's been seen in the post-Second World War period. What impact do you think that these phenomena are going to have on this whole debate about private involvement in public services? And I guess this is almost broader issue of the public reaction against these dirty capitalism words like privatisation and profit and competition.
That's a very hard question to call at the moment. There's no doubt that there's a shortage of cash around. People are still closing very, very big PPP, PFI-type deals, but it's not so easy. And the question is, will this be a permanent or actually just a temporary blip? And that's hard to call. One of the things that I think is quite important here, which leads me to think that it will be somewhat of a temporary blip, is that if you think at a slightly larger level, one of the big movements that's going alongside the sort of privatisation movements we've been discussing are the privatisation, as you might want to think of it this way, the privatisation of the protection of individuals in their old age. The movement now globally is to put this back onto the individuals via pension schemes of various sorts. The World Bank is pushing very much. They want countries to introduce these individual various pillars for people to look after themselves. You're finding this all through Western Europe, basically driven a lot by demographics, that the sort of simple pay-as-you-go public system just can't cope into the future. So what you're going to have is an ever-growing, or at least for the next 20 or 25 years, ever-growing investor institutions that need to invest very long-term in relatively safe assets. And they're going to need a home for this money. At the same time, a sort of natural home for a lot of this money are these very, very long infrastructure schemes with very, very long contracts signed. So you can see there's a kind of quite a natural fit there. Historically, the protection of people in their old age, which was looked at by the public sector at the time when the public sector was doing these infrastructure projects, you can see there's quite a neat fit with if it's the private sector that are now looking after their old age protection through private pension schemes sort of globally, that money now would go into this very same infrastructure that was being delivered by the public sector. So I can see that fit actually working out quite well in the long run. And therefore, I personally anticipate that although the growth in these schemes has to a large extent been driven by political pressures, those political pressures don't go away. So when it's easier again in the near future, hopefully, to fund these operations, they will continue. But there seems to be on a longer scheme of things, a more natural fit that would suggest that you could easily see that this model will continue. And it's really here to stay, I think.
Final question, Paul. You've been involved in research in this area for many years, tracking from the early 80s privatisation, seeing how they worked out. And you're still very much involved in looking at non-profit organisations now. But what do you see as the research agenda for the future in this area? What are the big questions that we need to answer? Where do we really need more evidence?
The whole issue of the not-for-profit, non-profit, relative to the private sector is one where there's a huge amount of theoretical research, there's a large amount of experiments about pro-social behaviour and that kind of stuff, and there isn't matching it a literature that can really answer the question of if governments decide to put a lot of their provision of public services through this not-for-profit route, what is that going to do? Is it going to make things better? Etc. And as I said, the one place where there is a reasonable amount of evidence is the US, but that may not transfer, so we may be looking at something different. So I think that's clearly an area that people need to look at in great detail. The issue of ongoing quality dimensions in partnership models is something that people will be put to bed eventually, one hopes. There'll be a clear message coming out of that. And a problem that we haven't really seen at all yet that we need to start to think about is the transfer of these assets as they get towards the end of their contractual life. Because how these models are typically constructed is that the private sector will build a road, the public sector will commit to buy from them the services of this road for 25 years or a hospital building or something of that sort, or a water facility. And then, at the end of that period, this is then transferred to the public sector, then make a decision what they do with that asset at that point. You can easily see that as you approach this closing time, the incentives for the private sector to keep these assets in good condition starts to deteriorate quite rapidly. So how all that will play out is something that will start to become of considerable interest, and we don't really know a lot about. And another area I think that we need to do a lot more thinking about is the whole issue of risk transfer. We know risk and bearing risk is important for incentives. We don't know a huge amount of how much risk is really transferred from the public to the private sector when the private sector is pulled in to deliver public services, because obviously there's an inherent role for the public. They can't walk away in the way that they can walk away from other activities. E-commerce companies can go down wholesale in 2000 and 2001, and the government don't have to be involved. Public service delivery companies can't go down wholesale in markets, and therefore who ultimately owns the risk and how this is all packaged is important. And again, actually, this comes back to the not-for-profit, because there's clearly an issue of what is appropriate risk transfer for the private sector may not be appropriate risk transfer if we're going to have a lot of not-for-profit delivery. And I don't think people have thought very much of what these optimal contracts would look like for delivery and transfer of risk into the not-for-profit sector. So there's plenty of things to think about, and hopefully I'll be spending some time thinking about some of these in the future.
Paul Grant, thank you very much.